you don't have a 2K. Well, actually, 1080p is like a 2K. Right. And 2XJ, and thank you.
Yeah, DaVinci is a great program, and I think I like to mess with it to get some kind of offbeat, abstract result.
Okay. Again, I wish you luck, David. I am sure that there are all kinds of interesting things that you could do. Wesley mentioned early in his discussion, Resolve sort of started as a coloration tool for professional cinematographers. They do a lot of color adjustments. A lot of times people don't notice, which is probably the point of the exercise, but it kind of blew out to all other things. There's a module for audio and all kinds of modules, so it's just a matter of checking out some YouTubes, doing some Google searches, and I'm sure there'll be a lot of tutorials available for this. There's probably books, but you got to pay for the books, so you're probably better off just go into the online tutorials.
Well, the color on the abstracts is phenomenal.
Well, that was its original intent way, 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 way back, to do the color correction for video medium. So it certainly has a very sophisticated control system to adjust for the nuances of image colors.
Yeah. So there were three standards. There was REC 709 and there was 2020, or 2022, I believe. Right. So those were standards, and those standards were for the color science, for the people who do the professional job, but also the guys who were making videos for the weddings, for the corporate events, they could use it too. Let me jump. So the whole world was using, but the equipment was extremely expensive. So all of the cameras were expensive too. Canon or Nikon. There was a time in 2010 when Nikon was extremely expensive, and I bought the Nikon, called Nikon sometime. Okay, Canon was also expensive. But then everything dropped. So we're talking about last 5 years, the expansion of Blackmagic to the point where nobody can keep up with them. They make all of the money and everybody is losing with them. And that's only just because of the color science. So the color science of Blackmagic is so absolutely amazingly great that could mimic a film on film from 1970s, mimic Arri, Alexa, and plenty of others who were using who were used by professional film companies. So now everybody can make a video for YouTube or video for your own memories or whatever you want, and it could be done with the greatness and the quality with sound and all effects and what you want and the 3D graphic in one program. You don't even have to use the Blender for it, although I prefer Blender because it's standing alone. And to actually...
You know, they were making a movie down on Hudson Street, and I saw the producer standing there. So I walked over to him and I said, somebody is going to make a full-length feature film with a DSLR and one light. I know the reason why. They bring a whole crew of people with all this equipment is because they get more money off the top. KG2RY.
It is absolutely true. DSLR are not used any longer. I still have a DSLR. I love it. But right now, mirrorless are in use. Every manufacturer is trying to make a video or photo camera to have ability for the full features of the movie, if you want to make a video, if you want to make in form of movie, and the only difference is RAW. RAW is the format where, if you look at RAW, it looks absolutely ugly and awful. It doesn't have a proper colors. It's just ugly. But then, if you put it to Blackmagic, to DaVinci Resolve, it shines. It simply shines. So right now, everybody, Sony, Canon, Nikon, Fuji, Panavision is no longer really used. Arri, everybody is using right now that raw signal, raw format. And only 2 years ago, I believe 2.5 years ago, Blackmagic announced their own RAW. And it happened that this RAW is so easy, it's so convenient, and they made a camera space on the RAW format as well. So in other words, we're talking about somebody who is putting all together in one, the software, the camera that works with the software, all of the features that are compatible with others, but others are not compatible with everything that they can produce that could be like one format. So we're talking. I remember there was a time when in New York there was a company called, there was an oil company that was doing alarms, started to do alarms for free. Schlumman Security System, Schlumman. Schlumman was the company that was doing oil, but they decided that if they do the alarm systems and put something else into the package, the oil sells better. And at one point they decided, well, because we make money on oil, why don't we just try to make the alarm system for free? People still have to pay monthly, we still make money, nobody's doing for free, and they actually, like I use the word, corrupted the market. So thousands of people, small guys who are doing the alarm systems, actually they close up or they decided that they cannot keep up with the market. They only could keep up with the small base of the clients who knows them and trust them. So the same story is right now with Blackmagic. The only thing is like Blackmagic is doing it worldwide. And to exist.
I didn't tell that producer that I would probably never see his movie. You know, I probably wouldn't have access to it, and I probably wouldn't have any interest to look at it, you know. So, I didn't tell him that.
Okay, 2208, it's a time for space report, Dr. Ray.
Okay, thank you, Wesley, and thank you, David. By the way, RAW formats are usually decided on by the manufacturer of the imaging technology, the camera makers and such. So there are RAW formats for different models of Sony, Nikons, and all the others. So my guess would be that Blackmagic offered their own solution to the problem, but it's up to the individual manufacturers to design their hardware to configure their RAW images in that particular format. RAW images are totally unprocessed. They have more data than any processed versions. And so you could manipulate dynamic range and other fun things with raw files that you certainly can't do with compressed files like JPEGs or MP4s and such. Anyway, it's been loads of fun. I thank you all. It's coming precariously close to the Magic 1015, so I'll just remind people that if you want to contact me through mail email, my email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. If you want to contact Paul, that would be spacenetreport@gmail.com. My link page is available on the Internet. Just type into your browser roy.ac2gs.com. And there is the audio link stream to the repeater 24/7. Just type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com, and that will give you the audio stream. And always like to remind people, MyKC2NJI has a great archive of all of the technical nets going as far back as September of 2006 at his site, which is amateurradio.tv. So keep it all in mind, and I'll be back a little bit later on to say goodnight again. So next up is Paul WS2N with the SpaceNet Report.
AC2GS WS2N. Very good. And everybody's audio tonight is great. You know, it's been like that for not only weeks, but for months. And Lou and his team are really doing a great job with these repeaters. It wasn't too long ago, years ago, we always had problems. Not always, but, you know, they were constantly crept up. Now, once in a while, but overall, this is a very, very good repeater. Anyway, there's a story on Dr. Roy's website about the solar orbiter that was launched just a couple of years ago, back in early 2020. And they launched it to, the idea is to orbit the sun, but eventually change its orbit to, instead of going around the, let's call it the ecliptic part of the plane, similar to the way all the planets normally go around the sun. They would like to get it to more of a polar orbit, where you maybe get 20, 30, and then eventually maybe 40 degrees, where you could see the northern and southern parts of the sun on a regular basis. That's what they would like. You know, we have plenty of spacecraft staring at the sun in the orbital plane, the planet's orbital plane. But we don't have anything looking to the poles or anywhere near the poles. We did it one time. We had a spacecraft called Ulysses, but, you know, it didn't last for long. This thing will last for many, many years once they get it to its proper inclination. But to do that, every it takes roughly 2 years, every 2 years, it goes around the sun, which is about 365 days. When you're in that close, it's like 160 days around the sun. So every two of those years, where it's located, they send it past Venus, and they angle it where it's not hitting the equatorial part of Venus, but heading toward the pole as it goes near the poles of Venus. This changes the inclination. They get a free ride to do this with power. You would need probably another gigantic rocket to do it. So over time, they keep doing this over and over, and each time they do it, the angle is increasing, which is it's really using orbital mechanics to their advantage to get it where they want it to go. Anyway, on his website, they talk about the solar orbiter. Well, in this case, it was very near Venus when it got hit with a solar flare. You know, a CME, coronal mass ejection. it happened to go in that direction when it was released from the sun toward Venus, so they were able to pick up with the instruments on solar orbiter. Plenty of information, so that was a winner for the scientists. They lucked out with that. There's another solar probe orbiting the sun. It's called the Parker Solar Probe. Now, that was launched roughly 2 years earlier. And each time it goes around the sun, it gets into a lower orbit. It picks up speed each time it goes near it, and it's, you know, creeping in little by little. And just recently, it was at, you know, maybe 12 million miles to the sun, 10, 7, and now it just got down to 5 million miles off the surface of the sun. Give me an idea, Mercury is out like 80, I think it's 36 million miles from the sun. Well, now this thing is down to 5 million. And NASA has been hoping that a coronal mass ejection would happen at the exact at an exact time when solar probe is going near the sun. They would like to go right through it. You know, those things open up like a big gigantic eye off the sun. Theoretically, I mean, if they time it right, you could go right through the middle of it with the Parker solar probe. So now that thing is very close to the sun. To get that near the sun, they actually had, even so, it's a relatively small spacecraft. They had to launch that on NASA's biggest rocket at the time, the not only the Delta IV, but the Delta IV Heavy, which is three Delta IVs essentially bolted together. And the idea was to actually slow the revolutions, to slow the speed around the sun to the point where you get captured by the sun's gravity, get you pulled in closer and closer to where Venus orbits the sun, and then they use Venus in this case to again change its orbit, the Parker solar probe, to get it in closer and closer to the sun each time it goes near it. This way, when it goes near the sun, it heats up to certain degrees, maybe 5,000-6,000 degrees, and then eventually it cools off when it gets away from the sun. It's highly elliptical orbit. It goes near the sun, all the way up to Venus, and around that way. And there's at least 7 or 8 more passes that are scheduled for this mission. You know, they allow a certain amount of time for all these missions, and I'm sure once they get past that, if the solar probe is still operating, they'll probably extend it and let it go on for more years. They always get mission extensions for all these spacecraft that are doing well. And, you know, they send them out for 5 years, and then they go, okay, well, let's make it a 10-year mission, and so on and so forth, which is really the way to go. Any comments, WS1? Anyway, if you go to Dr. Roy's site, maybe next week we can put information about the Parker solar probe there as well. And by the way, Parker, they named that after Eugene Parker. He was the guy that figured out that there were solar winds, you know, like a million years ago. He figured this out. And he was like over, I don't know, I think he was like 99 or getting close to 100 when the rocket was launched. So they actually brought him down to watch the rocket take off back in 2018. So you got to see that. He's no longer with us, but it was good that he got that credit for doing what he did. He was a top scientist in this field for his whole life. Let me drop it. Okay.
was going to talk about, I was hoping, a successful launch that was going to take place today. And it was supposed to go off at around 4 o'clock our time. It was being launched from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. And it's the Alpha rocket. They call it the Alpha rocket. And it's built by Firefly. Firefly is a new company. They've been around for quite a few years now, maybe I forget about 7 or 8 years at least. But at one point they were going bankrupt, and another company picked them up and they resurrected them, and they've changed the design of their rockets over the years. But they have this rocket, it's roughly 10-story high rocket now, that they tried to launch from California. They want to launch it west instead of the normal east direction. It's a test flight. I covered this rocket last year when they tried to do the same thing. And last year it got off the launch pad, and it lasted about 2 minutes, and then it went out of control, and then the FTS system was activated. That's the flight termination system to blow it up. And then they evaluated, you know, what went wrong at Firefly, and they figured out that it was this one little cable, little pin, they had multiple pins on the cable, snapped off, and they said some vibrations and something pushing against it. So they know they corrected that, and here they are a year later. They made some changes. They improved on the rocket thrust. I think they said they went up 8% higher. And they were supposed to launch today, which would have been, 4 o'clock our time, 3 hours earlier in California. But they got down to 1 minute, and they aborted. And the reason for it was they were low on helium in one of the tanks. Helium, they use helium to create a pressure in the tanks. When the tanks are being emptied, you would create a vacuum inside the tanks. No rocket would survive that. So they counteract that by putting an inert gas, in this case helium, in. And it was low on pressure. So then apparently they were going to launch again a couple hours later. And it was probably going to go off during the net, like they said, around 10 o'clock. But then they scrubbed until tomorrow. My guess is weather, but, they worked on the problem with the helium, but they still scrubbed anyway. I saw a lot of clouds coming in. I was looking at it. I was streaming it on one of the websites. So hopefully they get off the ground, because they plan on, like, next year maybe having a half a dozen launches. And then they're going to be able to put pretty heavy satellites into space, maybe up to, a little over 2,000 pounds, 2,500 pounds or so, which is a big vehicle for what they consider a small launch vehicle. Most of the small launch vehicles, like the Electron rocket by Rocket Lab that launches out of New Zealand, soon to be eventually, launched from Virginia as well. They only launch maybe 500 pounds at the most. This thing, it could do like 2,000, almost 2,500 pounds. And this company is working on another vehicle. This is called the Alpha, and they're working on the Beta. The Beta is going to be a much, much larger, a heavy lift vehicle. But we got a couple of years before we see that thing go up. I'd like to see them get this up. There's not too many companies. There's many companies trying to get to orbit. But the only ones that are doing it successfully right now on a regular basis are SpaceX, of course, Rocket Lab, and Virgin Orbital. That's the one where they use the 747. They bring up the rocket to 45,000 feet and drop it, and then it ignites and sends the payload into orbit. That's been working out, but there's dozens of other companies trying to do this. There's one company, Alpha. They successfully got one of their satellites into space, but then they had a problem after that. So they're making changes, complete changes for that company. But the more the merrier, because there's plenty of satellites to fill their manifest. Maybe tomorrow or so, I guess next week I'll report, hopefully report that Firefly has had a successful launch from California. It's an all carbon, it's a carbon 3D type of printing that actually makes this rocket, it's not a metal rocket. Any comments, WSWS. STS, the Artemis program. I thought by now this thing would be successfully around the moon. They'd be testing things out. It was going to be a 42-day mission, eventually land in the Pacific Ocean. And of course it never got off the ground. That's why they're working on it as we speak. They had the hydrogen, they had some other problems, but the last problem anyway was this hydrogen leak on an 8-inch diameter fill line that's pressed up against the vehicle, and there's no bolts or anything. This is a quick disconnect. When it launches, you always see everything disconnect from the rocket. So the seals, they believe the seals were damaged. So they built this enclosure, they made their own tent around the rocket engine, and on this 322-foot tall vehicle, instead of bringing it back to the vehicle assembly building, that they want, for a number of reasons, they want to open it up and see what it looks like right away, and see any kind of damage. Anyway, they replaced the seals. I believe, titanium seals. I'm still not clear on what these seals are made of yet. But on the 8-inch line, and also a 4-inch vent line. So the fill line and vent line, they decided to, the fill line was leaking. So since they added a part, they figured, let's do both. Now, the whole SLS rocket system to really test this out again, if they brought it back to the vehicle assembly building, they don't have the capability of pumping cryogenic temperature fuels into the vehicle. So they really need it at the launch pad. That was one of the other reasons they decided to leave it at the launch pad. Now that's that work is all done, from what I understand. I think completed probably today. They plan on doing a test on the 17th, and not launch on the 17th, but they want to test. They want to put the quick disconnect back as if they're going to launch, and they want to fill up all the tanks. You have two stages, and both stages are liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. So you're going to fill up, all four tanks with cryogenic temperatures. The fuel is like 420, minus 421, 422 degrees, something like that. And they try to get the idea is also to get the engines cool to minus 420 degrees Fahrenheit. before they lunch. So, you know, they start early, you know, whatever lunchtime is. They might start like a half hour early trying to cool these engines down. They release hydrogen gas, liquid gas, eventually gas turns to gas and takes heat away from all the metal and parts of the engines, the four engines. And they want to duplicate this as if, you know, as if it was launch day. They want to check to see if there's any leaks. You know, now's the time to fix it. They believe they've got it fixed. So now, if this all works out and they could agree with they call it the range, NASA is in charge of the range. They actually have a group down there that, you know, from Patterson Air Force Base that is in charge of the safety of the range. If they could approve these, they have FTS systems inside the vehicle, flight termination systems. Essentially, they're bombs. And, you know, if something goes wrong, these things, you know, go off and breaks up to a million pieces, and you don't have, you know, a core stage coming down on a condominium in Florida somewhere. So they have a lifetime to them. When they put them in, they said 20 days, and then they got an extension for 25 days. Now they're looking to go a little bit longer. And they're doing those reviews. If the range says no go, that's it. Then they'll bring the whole stack back to the vehicle assembly building and probably go back in sometime in October. If not, they say go. They're going to try for the 23rd of this month, which is, right around the corner. And if that doesn't work, they want to try September 27th. So hopefully they get the okay to do that and give it another try. I'd like to see this thing head out to the moon, go through a orbital insertion, and eventually deorbit and come back to Earth. You know, with all the scientific stuff and testing and playing around with the Alexa type of system that they have on board called Callisto. They're going to say, Callisto, do this. And, you know, we'll see. A lot of things have to be tested out before the thing can be human-rated. Once it's human-rated, they'll be able to put astronauts on this thing within a year and a half and fly it on, Artemis II, which is a completely brand-new Orion spacecraft. Well near completion. It's in Florida, and all the boosters and everything for Artemis II is well on its way to completion. So there you go. Any comments on the FTS system, WS2N? I heard W2HL, is it true?
W2HL, I'm low. I was wondering how long it takes for the capsule to reach the moon and go into orbit.
How long the capsule does what? You know, just put that for a second, so I missed that.
Yeah, one second. I've got the, your name there. What's your name again?
Yeah, the name is Paul, and WS2N.
Okay, Paul, it's Howard. I was wondering, how long does it actually take Artemis to reach the moon? at the launch before it goes into orbit. When does the capsule? I would assume the capsule where the astronauts will be. When does that separate? Does that separate before at moon orbit or before moon orbit?
Yeah, well, the capsule is married to the service module, which service module is being built by the European Space Agency. So it's all in one. They consider that set up the Orion. The Space Launch System, of course, launches. It's got, you know, the two solids on it, similar to what shuttle used to have. They'll come off in a little over 2 minutes. And then just to set the cores running with four RS-25 engines, the liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen engines, that will get it into actual orbit around eight minutes or so. After flight, those engines shut down. That separates, and then something called the interim cryogenic propulsion stage, which is just another stage on top of that, takes over. That's another liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen system, and that's the one that will push them through TLI, trans-lunar injection. So you're going to make one and a half revolutions around the Earth, and then that interim cryogenic propulsion stage, that upper stage, will launch, will ignite, and that will push the Orion spacecraft, which is the capsule, like you said, but also the service module. That will push it on its way to the moon. That final stage, that interim cryogenic propulsion stage, kind of like follows them along, but a little different angle. That eventually goes into solar orbit and will never be heard from again. The Orion system heads to the moon. In this case, it's going to take like 6 to 7 days actually before it gets into orbit with this flight. Normally with the Apollo missions, if you got a crew on board, they want to get them there as fast as possible. It took them, about 3.5 days to get there and another 3.5 days to get back. This is a test flight, so what they're doing is they would like to experiment with an eventual location where the Gateway space station will eventually be located, which is going to be like 40,000 miles away from the moon. They call it a retrograde orbit, halo orbit. They want to see make sure they're comfortable getting into that kind of an orbit, because eventually we'll have a crew doing that. So to get there, they're going to pass the moon. They're going to go around the moon once, and as they go around it, they're going to come within 100 kilometers, or roughly 60 miles off the lunar surface. But then they're going to keep going out to this distant 40,000 miles away now, just on this mission. And then they'll actually be in orbit around the moon at that time. There's only going to be like maybe 1.5 orbits, because each orbit takes, from that distance, takes like 11 at least 11 days to make one orbit. So at the end of that time frame, then they'll fire that rocket that's attached to the Orion, part of the service module system,
and that will push them back toward Earth. As they come back toward Earth, you know, it'll take like, you know, maybe four days to get back from wherever they are. Oh, by the way, this whole mission is roughly going to be around 39 days. Originally it was 42, but that's been changed. This whole thing is 39 days from launch. So now they're on the way back. They were pushed with the service module. They're getting close to the Earth's atmosphere. They'll do a separation again. The service module will go balance straight into Earth and burn up. But the capsule itself will be angled to actually start to almost like look like it's going to orbit the Earth. It'll suck on around. And then naturally they put the heat shield in the right direction. And that'll slow them down from 25,000 miles an hour down to around 300 miles or so. And then the drogue chutes will start coming out. I think there's a set of 11 chutes. You know, they have little drogue chutes, little pilot chutes that pull out the bigger chutes. And eventually we wind up with these three huge parachutes, which will land the spacecraft successfully in the Pacific Ocean at a gentle 16 miles an hour. That's the plan. And then now Artemis II, of course, will eventually have a crew, but it's going to have an orbit, different orbit set up. They're not going to go out to this 40,000-mile location. And then Artemis III, they will actually plan on landing on the moon. Back to you, Howard, WSLS.
Okay, very good. Thank you for the explanation. Very good, very good. Very interesting. Okay, so when do they expect to launch? I just didn't know the light, you might have said it. When is they expect to give it another try?
Yeah, and so far they've scrubbed twice. What was it, 2 Mondays ago, and then they scrubbed again on last Saturday. And then, but now they're going to try. If they get the okay, they have to get the okay. And they have to make sure that what they fix, this hydrogen leak on this 8-inch quick disconnect is all, you know, it's got a good seal. If that happens, and that's on the 17th, if that liquid fueling of the whole rocket with the cryogenics and testing of the seal is successful, then they plan on launching on the 23rd of September. But they have to have the okay from the range. If that's okay, they'll launch on the 23rd. If they scrub again, one more opportunity on the 27th. If that doesn't work out, they have to go back to the vehicle. The assembly building, which is a like 4.1 mile ride on a crawler, all the way back to the VAB building. And then eventually they'll go back to the pad again, and that will probably be probably the third week of October. Back to you, Howard. W2HL, WS2S.
Yeah, Roger. Well, they want to make sure that it's they get it right, that's for sure. Thanks for the explanation, Paul. Appreciate it. Very detailed. Very good. So back to you. Thanks for answering the question, W2HL.
Okay, you're welcome. And that's what Bill Nelson keeps saying. We'll launch when we're ready, you know. You know, he's treating this like, you know, like you have a crew on board, because they will have a crew on board a year and a half from now. And Bill Nelson, by the way, is the, I guess you probably know, the administrator of NASA. He's an old-timer now, but, you know, when he was younger, they put him on the shuttle. He was on the 24th mission of the space shuttle. got to fly for, I think, 5 days or so. And he was a congressman at the time. So, Congress, they decided, well, let's send a couple of politicians up there. Let's send somebody from Congress, and we'll send another guy from, one from the House and one from the Senate. I got this guy, Senator Gahn from the Utah, for the Senator group, and they had Nelson as the representative for the House. And they went on different flights. Gahn went first, and then eventually Bill Nelson. And I don't know, that changed his life, that's for sure. years later, he himself became a senator, and no longer a senator, and they decided to make him administrator of NASA. But he keeps saying that, we're going to launch when we're ready. The reporters keep asking him, well, what about all the people who came out to the hotels and sitting there? You know, he feels bad for everybody, but, you know, he goes, this is what we do. It's part of the space business. Any other comments? WS Tour. Okay. Is a company called Rocket Lab. I've talked about them many times on the net. And they launch Rocket, you know, they launched that out of New Zealand. Eventually, they plan on launching it out of Virginia, Wilds Island, Virginia. They have their launch complex built there and everything. They just need the approval from the government. But they've been launching on a regular basis. I think 25 launches or so out of New Zealand. He's got two launch complexes there. He's becoming very confident in what they're doing. And he's eventually got another vehicle he plans on building called the Neutron rocket, which is a large rocket. You know, the Electron rocket could maybe put 500 pounds of something into orbit. This thing here, you'd probably put, you know, maybe 12,000 pounds or so into orbit with the Neutron rocket. Big rocket, and he plans on building this also in the United States. Actually, he's setting up a factory in Virginia.
Hey, Paul?
Yes, Howard, go ahead.
As a tidbit, when I had my own private limo, private luxury car service some years ago, I had Jake Gahn as a customer, and he was telling me about his experience, and he told me that he vomited in the, some point in the mission.
Yeah, oh, that's a great story. Great story. You are, not that he got sick, but that you were, you got to know him even, you know, for a little bit. That's great. Yeah, he was very sick during the flight. Now, which is strange. Yeah, he come out of the military. He flew a lot of, you know, planes, different types of planes. He had a lot of hours doing this type of thing, flying. But for some reason, space travel didn't agree with them. So now they have, they have this this gauge, you know, instead of measurements by feet or weight by pounds, they have the severity of throwing up on a flight. And they have different numbers, you know, 5 gone, 4 gone. If you have 1 gone, that's like the worst, you know. It's like DEFCON 1 or something. So, yeah, that he wound up notoriety for that. But interesting. That's a great story, Howard.
Hey, Vega Hagen.
We became friends and had him a few other times. And that I remember that very well. I think he told me that he gave a kidney to his wife or daughter. I can't recall exactly. But he was involved with a transplant. Anyway, very interesting, and I have to sign, so I thought I'd tell you about that. So 73 for now. Still listening, W2HO.
Okay, were you working out in Utah, or was it, where were you picking him up?
No, I was in New York, and he came into New York a few times. He was working for Huntsman Chemical, and he had business in New York, and I was at the time had a private luxury car service, and he was a customer. Back to you.
Yeah, and he's still around, just like Bill Nelson. Bill Nelson's our kid, and this guy, he's up to, I don't know how old he must be now, but I know he's still around. Okay, very good. Thanks for that, Howard, and come back on the net. So if you have any more great space stories like that, and by the way, they say 50% of the astronauts that go up get sick. You know, I don't know if you ever read that, but that's a common occurrence. And eventually they straighten themselves out. They said, who was it? On Apollo 8, Frank Borman, he was commander. He had Lowell with him and Anders. And their mission was just to go around the moon. Similar to what Artemis 2 is going to do. They're going to go around the moon and come back. They're not going to land. So they're more or less going to duplicate, kind of duplicate this flight. The orbital mechanics is going to be different, but of course it's going to be shorter. I mean, this mission, Artemis 1, is going to be 39 days. Original plan was 42, but time has gone by since they scrubbed, and the moon is in a different location. Anyway, they have still over a month where the spacecraft itself is only designed for 21 days, you know, the Orion spacecraft, with a crew. So that when that crew goes up, it's going to be less than 21 days. You know, Mike, it's probably be a 12-day mission with Artemis 2. But when Frank Borman went up, he went all the way to the moon and back, sick as a dog, they said. And that was closer quarters, the amount of cubic feet space that you have in Orion compared to Apollo is significantly different. The only other difference, of course, in Orion, now they're going to put a crew of four. That's going to be the general number. Apollo was three. Any comments? WS2N.
Hey, Vega Hagen.
Call letter. Anyway, there's going to be a couple of other companies that want to do what Rocketland plans on doing. Actually, it's a request from the military. The military would like to see some companies, in this case, it's Rocket Lab and two other companies, Sierra Nevada with their Dream Chaser spacecraft, and also Blue Origin. They're building a large rocket with called the New Glenn, and they would like these companies to eventually, you know, deliver cargo or maybe even people from one part of the earth to another part. Let's say the military needs something very important, and they need it in on the other side of the earth, like tomorrow. They could put it on one of these spacecraft and launch it and get it to that location. Long-term plans, I mean, that's not going to happen tomorrow, but they're already in discussion with these private companies to do just that. You might want to have something, because there's a natural disaster on the other side of the world somewhere, and they need to send something there. You know, like I said, bottles of water, maybe it's medicines or something that has to get there, like, tomorrow. And the military wants that. So they're going to start actually helping these private companies, pouring money into their companies to eventually do that. Which could make a big difference. You know, NASA's budget, well, years ago, I don't know, 5, 10 years ago, NASA's budget used to be like $18 billion, then it went to 19, 20. Anyway, I think this year, actually for the beginning of next year, it's going to be around $25 billion for NASA. And a lot of people think, well, you know, all these rockets that are going up have to do with NASA. Well, they don't. That NASA launches rockets. They'll pay for seats on other rockets. But all these other a lot of rockets you see going up have nothing to do with NASA. They have to do with national defense. You have the NRO, National Reconnaissance Office, launching satellites and military and Air Force. You know, there's all kinds of military things that are involved with the space program. They have their own budget. They have something called the X-37B that's in space right now. It looks like a small space shuttle. It goes up it used to go up for 6 months or so, and then for a year, 2 years. This thing's been up for like 2.5 years. I think last I read it was over 700 days. Still up there, doing God knows what for the government. But eventually they bring it back down. When they bring it back down, it lands on a runway. The earlier one lands. Now, this is since, 2011 they've been doing this. Correction, 2010. Anyway, they take the X-37B and it just land on a runway in Edwards Air Force Base. And the last couple of ones have landed in Florida on the same runway that the shuttle used to land on. So the X-37B, they have two of them. When one goes up, the other one gets refurbished, and the other one it goes around that way. I think this is around the sixth time they've launched these things, for years at a time. And then they bring them back.
Complete.
All that money, I mean, they launch on a Atlas V rocket, put a fairing around it, protect it, goes up. They also got a contract with SpaceX. SpaceX is the same thing. They put this X-37B inside the big fairing on a SpaceX rocket, and they put it into space. But that money is not coming from NASA. It's all private military money. The military space program and, National Reconnaissance Office and all, is about twice as much. The space program for them is about twice the budget that what NASA has. So, which is interesting, everybody thinks, well, NASA, maybe they get too much money. Look at the military; they're getting a ton of money to do these things. And that, of course, that's just the space program for them. And there's a lot behind it, you have NORAD and everything else, and, it's all part of that, their budget. Anyway, I'd like to see these companies eventually do that. I mean, to be able to have that capability, whether they do it or not, I think it's great. It's like anything else, like ham radio. You don't know you need a ham until the lights go out, and then you you can get the answers from them. Any comments or questions?